This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Raggio, Senior Fellow, Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, my colleague and co-host, and we welcome John Hardy of FTD, watching Ukraine and Russia along the battlefront and at the negotiating table. John, a very good evening to you. A scattershot of headlines in these last hours. I begin with the question of the Black Sea ceasefire that we talked of last week. There is no indication that has started. I'll ask you about that. At the same time, the dominant headline in Reuters, that's Europe reporting, is that Mr. Trump is very unhappy with the Kremlin feet dragging in some fashion on getting to the negotiating table. The response from Moscow, the Kremlin, is that Mr. Putin quietly stated that he believes an interim government is necessary before peace negotiations. He doesn't want a ceasefire, he wants peace. And in order to get an interim government, that means either hold elections or move Zelensky out of the way. The fighting on the front I leave to you, but I do mention that in these last hours, there are reports of the Russian attacks continuing, including one against a hospital. Good evening to you, John. How would you describe the Russian conduct with regard to drone attacks, especially the sensitive area of the energy grid of Ukraine? Has that continued? Because that was part of the discussion last week when they were talking about a ceasefire. Good evening to you, John.
Hey, John. Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me back on the show. Certainly, both sides are still conducting strikes and both accusing each other of violating the energy ceasefire by striking energy facilities, notably Naftogaz, one of Ukraine's energy companies, accused the Russians of striking gas production facilities late last week. For my part, I can't confirm any of these strikes, but it would not be surprising if the Kremlin is testing the boundaries of this ceasefire with Trump and seeing how the U.S. might respond.
There is no ceasefire, but there would be if Mr. Trump was able to push that codicil forward on the table. Is that correct, John?
Both sides have agreed to a 30-day ceasefire in the air on strikes targeting energy facilities. One thing to know is that the Kremlin put forward a list of prescribed targets that did not include Ukrainian oil and gas production facilities, and include various Ukrainian infrastructure, but not those facilities specifically. And reportedly, the Ukrainians have handed the U.S. a list that they say is agreed with the United States that does include them. So there's still kind of a lack of clarity on what exactly is prescribed or off limits, and whether the Russians are abiding by it. I think the United States needs to provide some clarity on what exactly was agreed to and also the consequences if the Kremlin has indeed violated the ceasefire.
So there is a ceasefire. We just can't see it. Is that the way to leave it, John?
There is a ceasefire currently regarding energy infrastructure. The Black Sea deal that was recently kind of they reached a preliminary agreement or agreement in principle on is still, I think, a work in progress. The Russians have put forward various demands for partial sanctions relief with regard to their food and fertilizer exports, which the EU has essentially rejected, including the reconnection to SWIFT, the international financial messaging service for a Russian bank that was de-SWIFTed after the war began. So, Europe has sort of a veto on some of the Russian demands. And so far that Black Sea deal is still sort of being worked out.
Bill, I hand it off to you. Fog of ceasefire. Good evening, Bill.
Good evening, John. Hello, John. I have a question for you concerning these limited ceasefires. I must admit, I don't know what I think of it. Do you think it's wise to proceed with limited, ceasefires, limited to sections of the war? Is this workable?
I think it could be a good way to sort of get the ball rolling. And it's certainly good for Ukraine and for the Russians, for that matter, to have these strikes on their energy infrastructure stop for Ukraine in the Black Sea. If that deal were to lead to, say, a halt to strikes on port infrastructure in Odessa, to maybe even the reopening of the Mykolaiv port. I think that, you know, that would be positive. What's important with the Black Sea, especially, is that you don't sort of just have the status quo and then the Russians bank concessions on sanctions relief and potentially use those new sanctions relief loopholes to weaken the broader sanctions regime and sort of use those carve outs as a way to bring in money and equipment related to their war effort that doesn't have anything to do with food or fertilizer. And by the way, we should note that as much as the Russians say they pulled out of the Black Sea grain deal in 2023, and as much as they demand sanctions relief for food and agriculture exports now, those exports have actually been booming. So clearly the Russians aren't having difficulty getting those products to market.
Let's go to the battlefield, John. When last we spoke, there was a sliver of Ukrainian forces in the Kursk salient that had been a gambit for many months. There was a battalion strength believed in Belgorod Oblast on the Ukrainian border, and there was no progress in Pokrovsk. Let's begin with the salients. What is the status of Ukrainian forces now? Have they put new stuff in? Are they taking people out?
So in Kursk, the Ukrainians are still holding on to some kind of high ground near the border, just maybe a few towns or villages, rather, at this point. The Russians have made some additional gains toward the border and perhaps in nearby Sumy Oblast. No huge changes since we last spoke a week ago, but essentially the Russians are still trying to claw back the rest of that territory. Turning a little bit to the south in Belgorod, kind of near the junction between the Belgorod, Kursk, and Sumy Oblast, the Ukrainians have continued to conduct kind of small scale attacks in Belgorod Oblast toward, you know, two or three, four small border villages. Not a whole lot of movement there, but fighting does continue.
And Pokrovsk.
So first, I should just say that after a kind of dip in Russian attack tempo in, say, the February, early March time period, the Russian rate of assault has climbed back up. So we had a few days last week where there was Ukrainian general staff reported over 200 assaults per day. It's remained pretty high. So it looks like after that sort of winter lull, the Russian operational tempo was picking back up. Its rate of gain has picked up a bit compared to the really just completely stagnant rate that we saw a few weeks ago, but it's still pretty low. So we'll just have to wait and see whether that trend continues or not. I think in general, the Russians over the winter needed to kind of reorganize, regenerate, reequip, following some pretty heavy losses in that fall winter campaign, and they were also dealing with, you know, things like weather that can reduce concealment and cover for, you know, Russian dismounted infantry due to leaves falling off deciduous trees. You know, weather can impede glide bomb strikes. So I think that those are some of the reasons that you saw the Russians kind of lull there in the winter. And the Ukrainians have also been adapting well, as we've discussed on previous shows. So I think we'll have to see whether this kind of resumption in high tempo for the Russians leads to an actual resumption in the relatively quick rate of gain we saw last fall.
I mentioned that Pokrovsk is at the crossroads between Donetsk Oblast and Dnipro Oblast there, and that is not a claim. Donetsk Oblast and Luhansk Oblast, Zaporizhia Oblast, and Kherson Oblast are the claim by the Kremlin, along with Crimea. Bill, you have a question.
Yes, just south of Poprosk, there is a small salient developing, and it's coming close, as John mentioned, to Donetsk. Dnipro province. Is this a real threat to the Ukrainians, or is this a limited gain? Do you think the Russians could possibly slip behind the Ukrainian defenses on this front?
Yeah, so that, I think, is a dangerous course of action that could happen. If and when the Russians do manage to capture the city of Pokrovsk, again, this, for folks who are unfamiliar, this is a small city in kind of the western part of Donetsk Oblast in eastern Ukraine that for a long time served as a key logistics hub. It's, you know, that function is no longer, it no longer serves that function given that the Russians are so close to the city. They've been trying to envelop it from two sides to cut key roads to the city. And really haven't made any gains there in the past couple months. In fact, the Ukrainians have been conducting some limited counterattacks and reclaimed a little bit of territory. If the Russians eventually do take Pokrovsk, they really have two different options. They could try to push north toward the cities of Kramatorsk and Slovyansk. These are the last big cities in Donetsk Oblast that the Ukrainians control. Or the Russians could kind of hook left and push into that Dnipropetrovsk Oblast. I'd say that's the most dangerous course of action, because if you compare just the preparedness and level of fortifications that the Ukrainians have set up, like they're much better prepared to contend with that northward push toward Kramatorsk and Slovyansk.
The weather is improving, although this is mud season in Ukraine. Is there any change in tactics on the front lines or thinking strategically? Are they bringing more vehicles in, more drones used? How so, John?
So we touched on the impact of weather a bit. It certainly has warmed up. I think spring has really arrived in eastern Ukraine. In terms of drones, for the past few months, we've seen the Ukrainians expanding some of their best UAS units. So forming, regiments and in one or two cases a brigade, to kind of expand these units' ability to serve as force multipliers and conduct strikes in kind of the tactical depths of the front, and increase the amount of frontage they're able to cover. So that follows on Ukraine expanding strike drone companies to battalions in most of the maneuver brigades, including actually also the artillery brigades along the front line. So you kind of have these interlocking pieces of strike drone units that can take different parts of tactical depth and different parts of the front, and really form a system of drones. And basically, what the Ukrainians try to do is hit the Russians through drone drop mines, FPV first person view strike drones, drone drop munitions, to really stop them before they reach Ukrainian positions. So if done successfully, the Russian vehicles and dismounts are attrited before they reach the Ukrainian position, which as we discussed before, tend to be fairly undermanned. So infantry is still the big problem for Ukraine, but they have been compensating to a significant degree through this tactical adaptation with strike drone units.
John Hardy of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy and the Fog of War on the Battlefront. Bill Raggio is here as my colleague and co-host. We're headed to the Fog of Negotiation. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.